I don't know how many of you listened to the testimony last Wednesday, but it was really deeply moving. And in some ways, I consider myself giving a few footnotes this evening to what we heard last time, because last time it was a human life, the reality of a human life searching and being found. And that is always so amazing for me to hear. That is, as far as I'm concerned, the miracle in our lives when a person turns to the triune God. Ron is passing out a handout that I have prepared for tonight. And Ron has already mentioned that I have tried to give a talk at a Labrie conference about this same subject. I didn't do very well when I presented that for multiple reasons, and one of them was it was just simply too much. And so what I want to do this evening is give you a little bit of an overview of where I think I would encourage you to go as you reflect on the interconnection, the relationship between those who follow Christ and those who are seekers of one way or another, and to connect those two a little bit more carefully. So that's what I'd like to do this evening, just to help us think that through a little bit. So some of the things that I mentioned, some of the trends that I have identified in the United States and in Europe in particular, are really just examples. I'm not standing here to give you the final analysis of the current spiritual trends. That would be preposterous, impossible, and not helpful. So really, think about it with me in the sense of example. And so the topic is spirituality, or maybe even plural, spiritualities in contemporary cultures, current spiritual yearnings, self-disclosures, and self-assertions, and then to compare that with discipleship dynamics in the Gospel of Mark, to just pick out one of the Gospels and see how those two trajectories connect. Let me just begin with one brief example. Some of you know the author Anne Rice. She was a well-known writer, published in the tens of millions of books on vampires and various other sundry beings. And as of a few years ago, she made a profession of faith, and this is what she says concerning her most recent book called Called Out of Darkness, A Spiritual Confession. This is what she says, quote, "I do think that those dark books, looking back on her writing career as a U.S. author, I do think that those dark books were always talking about religion in their own way. Now listen to this. They were talking about the grief for a lost faith." So she is self-analyzing her many books on vampires and various other imagined beings as a grief for a lost faith. In 2002, Rice broke away completely from atheism, which she had been involved with for nearly four decades. She left the church, in her case the Roman Catholic Church, when she went off to college, and she got deeply involved in existentialism, Martin Heidegger, Albert Camus, Jean-Paul Sartre, and she says herself, "Religion was too restrictive for my life, too out of step." So here are four decades of just completely turning her back to anything regarding spirituality. And then she says, "Yet religion had to come back into my life. It was something that she had to face up to, like an absent parent or a long-lost love child." Now, the reason I'm giving that as an introduction is simply to illustrate what we heard last week from Susanna. And that is, there is a real human heart searching in this seemingly dark world. Rather than to look at a person who is not a follower of Christ as somebody that just needs to come into the fold, that needs to come to believe. So what I'm concerned about is for us just to get a sense of the reality of a sincere struggle of life. If we don't feel, for instance, the reality of a stranger in Albert Camus, and the real horror of living in that kind of a world, the real hopelessness, the meaninglessness where even murder doesn't make a big difference in terms of good or wrong, right or wrong. That is exemplified here in some of this writing by Camus, for instance. And we need to be able to feel some of that. We need to be able to enter that. And I think Susanna did a wonderful job last Wednesday to just take us into her world, her search, her meandering, her exploration. And so what I'm going to try to give you is a little bit of an insight, far from caricaturizing, a little bit of an insight, where are our fellow human beings right now searching? Where are they locked? Where are they imprisoned? Where are they hitting a wall? Where are they confounded? Where are they trying to find some meaning which is perhaps from a perspective of a follower of Christ, a crutch? But for that person in that situation, that existential situation of search, it's quite the hope, quite the thing to pursue. So that just in the beginning for us to just get to a place of understanding that we live in a world in which struggles, in which different searches for meaning are very real, very substantial, very understandable. And in the experience in my own personal life with members of my family and just talking with people, I have slowly begun to feel the weight and the impact of other paths of life. And so it's all the more miraculous to me, all the more wondrous to me when God in His mercy brings relief, liberates a existentialist person from the confounding meaninglessness of a life of the stranger into true community, into true belonging, into true identity, etc. And just today in one of the lectures, I said that Christianity is really not a religion, but it is truth. It is reality. It is finding true life. And what we handle in terms of the call to discipleship is not a religious trip, but it is a walk into life. And so I just want us to get the reality dimensions, both of searches, of various journeys that people are on. My focus is mostly the United States and Europe on the one hand, and the reality of what is going on in the call to discipleship on the other. I didn't find the quote, but you know that Augustine said something like this: "You have created us for us, and our hearts are restless until they find peace in you." Now, that's a wonderful glance both into God's pursuing love on the one hand, but also into the heart of any human being in this world, and an empathy, an understanding of the shadow of the remnant of something in every human being's life. as that person seeks to deal with their joys and pains, etc. Now, what I want to give you is a little bit of a definition of spirituality and contemporary cultures so that we understand what we're talking about. I would define spirituality as seeking transcendent knowledge, and I'm going to define transcendent in just a minute. Wisdom, seeking a feeling, having an intuition, an experience of something beyond. And in today's world, spirituality does not necessarily need to mean transcendent in the old philosophical sense of truly in the world of metaphysics, in the world of God, in the world of that which is outside of what we can sense, feel, smell, and identify and know. So transcendence in today's definition of spirituality is maybe just going beyond yourself. So community can already be transcendent. So we see that sometimes these words are used a little bit like Plato, and you really have to ask, what are you talking about when you say you are seeking spirituality? And then obviously in the contemporary cultures, the plural comes from Nelson Jennings. He has helped me to see that there really is a multiplicity of different subcultures and movements, both in the United States, in Europe, anyway, in all kinds of different nations. So it's forms of transcendence, search for transcendence in different spheres, different cultural subgroups, religious subgroups, and maybe I can just throw this in. One thing that appears to be a trend right now is the ghettoization of all of these various trips. And Christians are not exempt from that trend. And by that I mean people are hunkering down into their own groups. They do not want to hear opposing views. They do not want to get exposed. They do not want to be questioned. So there's this particularization in these various spiritual movements, in these various subcultures, and everybody just says, leave me alone, I'm in my group. And I hear that from Christians sometimes as well, so that's an interesting trend anyway. So spirituality primarily looking for something beyond in terms of the old philosophical sense of metaphysics, transcendent, but also in some circles, some cultural movements today, it is simply looking for something bigger than yourself. That already would be defined as spiritual with some people. Now, when I began to just look around, look at pieces of writing that Ron put out on the table back there, read different journals, and just began the process of saying, excuse me, what's around? What's happening right now? What do we find? I started finding that it's helpful to have three major piles. So whatever I picked up, I saw, that fits on that pile. Here's another trend, there's another spiritual movement. That seems to fit on this pile. And then something else that fits on this pile. So what I'm giving you here in these three points on the first page is really what has come up as I studied these various trends in characterizations for these three piles. And the three piles that I found was spiritual yearnings. So those are expressions in various subcultures, in various spiritual movements, in various subgroups where there are clear yearnings expressed. There's some longing there, something of the Augustinian longing, although not always this true transcendence, longing for God, maybe just longing for something bigger than self, something bigger than your paycheck, something bigger than having an apartment, getting married, and dying. Not necessarily the search for God. That's one pile that I was amazed about how rich it is when you begin to say, what is your yearning? What are you longing for? So that was the first pile. The next pile that I found was spiritual self-disclosures, and I think that's particularly arising in the last 20, 30 years. As a young person, especially growing up in Europe, things were pretty private and not disclosed. I think we are in a time, maybe connected with the label postmodernism, where it is no shameful thing to say, this is where I'm at, this is what I believe, this is what I hold, this is what I am, what has meaning for me. So the area of self-disclosure, saying this is where I'm at, is quite interesting, and certainly you can learn a lot from that. What would you disclose about yourself? Not just where are your yearnings, but what would you disclose about yourself? And then, not surprisingly, the third pile arose as spiritual self-assertions. No way can I accept any person that does not support gay marriage. That's my self-assertion. And if you question that, you're just not acceptable. Okay, so something where a person would be very adamant about, very deterministic about, we need to be very tolerant. And if you're not tolerant, I'm going to push you. Okay, so that can be a self-assertion as well. And I found that as I looked around, most trends, most spiritual trends, fit either on one or two, and in some cases on three of these piles. They either contain all three or one or two of those elements. And what was helpful for me is to isolate them a little bit, to understand a little bit of what is going on. What I want to do for a few minutes is just go through these sub-points here a little bit. Now, some of them I can't say much about. I do not know much about. Some of them I could go on a little longer. That's what I want to do with you, to engage with you, and for you to just say, can we talk a little bit more about this or that or the other? Spiritual yearning, spiritual self-disclosure, or spiritual assertion. But what I want to do is not go very deep into these trends, and then to seek a path from these shadows, from these echoes of Eden, from these glorious ruins, as Schaefer has said, see how Jesus' call to discipleship actually plugs in with spiritual yearnings, spiritual self-disclosures, and deals rather head-on with spiritual self-assertions. So that there's actually a correspondence, not in any way that these self-disclosures, these yearnings and these assertions, if properly handled, will naturally lead to a knowledge of the triune God. I don't think that is ever affirmed in Scripture, but that there is some kind of a connection that we can find, so that every human being that we encounter in some ways holds a remote echo, a shadow, something that is being called up by Christ's call to discipleship. He's not leading into a religious trip, religious movement. He's picking up real human beings who have been created by God for life with God. So it stands to reason that there would be some correspondence, and that's what I'm trying to do here. So let me go through this rather briefly and quickly. And then what I'd like for you to do as I go through that, just identify which of these areas you would like for us to discuss a little more. And in some areas, I'll have to put up my hands or say, Ron has some papers on Kabbalah back there. I have not much understanding there. Actually, no, I'll take that back. Write your questions on your cards. That was the good idea of putting the cards around. So as I go, just note down on the cards what you would feel would be helpful to go a little bit deeper into. But my main concern is really not an exhaustive or exhausting discussion of each of these areas, but to get a feel for the trajectory. And I would love to hear from you whether you think this rings right in your own hearts, in your own understanding. So let me look at some of these points briefly. Under spiritual yearnings, I found a common denominator. And the common denominator is really the existential pain in the experience of life. Life is hard. Just the basic sense that there are yearnings in the midst of the labor of existence. Getting up, going to school, taking care of the basic needs of life and the seeming routine of that, then the pains and painful experiences in life, all of these aspects kind of underlie then the yearnings for something great. Let me give you a list here of what I found, and it's just a bunch of experiences that I have collected here in reading about this. It is these sense of experience of life, a reaction to fear, a sense of alienation, isolation, loneliness, meaninglessness, anger, depression, rejection of authority, especially political authority, rejection and tiredness about materialism, fear of responsibility, appeal among the young of the culture of death, an intense sensitivity to psychological and physical suffering, cynicism, truth fragmentation, relativism, a victim mentality, a high sensitivity to anything critical, a fear of manipulation, a restlessness, disorientation, guilt, shame, and failure. And that's just a start of it. It's incredible, it's overwhelming, but that's just being accumulated by people who go through the process of life. Now, this basic sense that is so complex and so complicated spawns, I believe, these five areas particularly. One of them is a longing, therefore, because of all of these things, for transcendent experience. And now we come back to this word transcendent. Not necessarily, I feel full of meaninglessness. Is there a God? More the traditional question. But I feel full of meaninglessness in my apartment. What is it? Nearly 50% of young people, young professionals in Germany are singles, living in some cooped up apartment somewhere in Frankfurt, Cologne, Munich, or Stuttgart, or Hamburg. I need to get out of that. My yearning for transcendent experience is some community, some group, some association beyond myself. That would already be called transcendent. That would already be called a spiritual yearning in some people's minds and hearts. So out of this morass of the pain of existence, this would be one thing. I need to get out. I need to find a transcendent experience somewhere, something that returns meaning to getting up in the morning. Number B, section B, which was surprising to me, is that many younger people, according to various statistics and various researches, especially in the United States, hope that family and a community of love would give a transcendent experience. Not necessarily that it would constitute that, but that in family and in a community of sorts, you would find transcendent experiences. And if you listened carefully to Susanna, part of her search was in community. There was some drive to derive meaning from the community that she was associated with. A third area that I do not know much about, but Michael Fogas and others would know much more about this area, is to seek solace in westernized Buddhism. I think it's important here to put this westernized in there. Is that correct, Michael? But there is a sense of getting out of the rat race of car repairs, car inspections, etc., and the whole nine yards, to something serene, something that goes beyond Buddhism. Then I have identified also the yearning and the longing for an ultimate harmony between nature and whatever would be divine. So we saw that a little bit in Susanna, in her testimony. There's a sense of where there is good organic food, there is God. Where there is a non-materialistic society that does not use foreign oil, there is God. Even, what was it, a person and a leaf was about the same value that she mentioned. I hope I understood that right. But there's this correspondence between nature and the divine, very strongly. And that has a scientific component in which people still seek, archaically perhaps, a harmony between natural sciences and revelation. So that's the pendant there. And then, interestingly, last of the things that I found, a return to tradition and ritual. There's a strong pull, certainly in various religious communities, towards tradition and ritual, but also in various movements outside of traditional Christian groups and communities. A sense that tradition gives meaning, ritual gives meaning. It again helps me to transcend the small, confined space of a individualized, lonely life. So tradition gets me out. It's a sense of transcendence. I'm connected with the ancient thought. Ritual is doing the same thing. So this would be the first area. The second area is spiritual self-disclosure, and that's the most shocking one. When you look at what has been found in investigations in various studies of what especially young people under the age of 30, mostly 20s, early 20s, say about themselves, and there is a perturbing self-admission to Spiritism, Satanism, ancestor worship, and superstition. It's just overwhelming. And in our modern world, in our post-Spiritist world, we really don't like to hear about that, but it is surprisingly strong in the United States and in Europe. So this would be the area of not only seeking some vague transcendence, something real out there, it is trying to make contact with real beings. And it is in a neutral sphere that does not say there could be good and evil out there. It's just anything that lives out there. Let's see. So ancestor worship, and then particularly Satanism and Spiritism, seeking the encounter with the netherworld. Very directly, very specifically, very focused with whoever can help me to make contact with those worlds. And it doesn't matter what I find, but it gives me such a thrill to be encountering something real out there. It's huge. And then superstition is in some of these areas kind of a segue, kind of a gate into connecting with that world. A second area is admission to surrender to fate, determinism, or chance. There is no meaning in this universe. I do, and I'm speaking for some people here, I do believe in the random chance origin of the universe, and maybe there's some kind of a fate principle out there. It just hits me. I had a conversation once on a plane flying to Europe with an Asian woman who was completely involved in fate. I mean, everything was just discerning and finding out how fate was guiding her. And fate wasn't a person or a reality, it was just something, this principle that she could not fight against, that was just great and strong determinism, very similar. And then chance, the other thing. Doesn't matter. Turn right, turn left, do this, do that. It's all meaningless. But now it is turned into a spiritual self-disclosure by which I say, let's see, let's try, let's experience, let's explore. So there is a transcendent element to life in chance. And then obviously this has been with us for at least 30, 40, I don't know how many years, New Age, the attraction of various forms of New Age. I remember Suzanne and I went to Findhorn one time in Scotland, a New Age community up there in Scotland, and they have the largest cabbages in Europe. I mean, it's a terribly bad climate up there, but they just grow vegetables like it's going out of style. So you just wonder, what's going on in this community? New Age community, nature, harmony, health, foods, etc. All kinds of things are put together. And then an area I don't want to go very much into is the area of Islam and its attraction, self-disclosures there. And maybe the Jewish Kabbalah should not be subsumed here, but rather in another area. But I just wanted to have mentioned that. The third area are spiritual self-assertions. Here we're more getting into the world of will. These are non-negotiables. And it's just interesting that we find the complexity of a human soul to be yearning, honesty, and a firm commitment. This is what I hold, and I will not surrender. What are some of those? Well, the area A is certainly huge, and don't ask me too many questions about that because I could get carried away on that. That is a little bit more of the area of interest where I have gone a lot in my own development. It's the area of philosophical atheism that is currently being remarketed with the so-called new atheism. Richard Dawkins and others, just what is going on currently is in some ways just a continuation of centuries of thought. Now, why do I bring that in here? The reason I bring it in here is because it's interesting that we have one of the subgroups in our total spiritual world at this point that rearticulates that there is no philosophical reason for God. So it's kind of an anti-spiritualism. But the reason why I'm bringing that in here is because these people know that there's no God. And they feel very strong in their self-assertion that whatever you live by, whatever you go for, cannot include the reality of a creator God. So it's a spiritual search with Immanuel Kant and others that have come to the conclusion there is absolutely no God, and therefore that's what we have to live with now. So there's kind of a certainty about the absence of God. Atheism, and then obviously the softer form is agnosticism that says, maybe there is a God, but I certainly don't know. I have not been contacted by that God lately, so who knows? There are all kinds of different trajectories in that, but I would include it under spiritual self-assertions because with Immanuel Kant, you would have gone through all the proofs, philosophical proofs for the existence of God, and you would have come to the conclusion, none of them sticks. Not even Thomas Aquinas' ontological proof of the existence of God. Doesn't work. I am sure. And then you go back to live in an atheistic world. So that is number A. It is very strong in Europe, but I do also notice here in the United States that that is rising, this kind of a movement combined with a rigid scientific model. So there's something going on there that is very self-assertive. And I do draw some connections here between apologists and Islam and that trajectory that I've just described. Number B would be a secularist self-assertion in the big vacuum of meaning. Particularly a French philosopher is working on that at this point. She is basically saying it is surprising that despite this vacuum of meaning that is admitted to, there is a self-assertion that says, I am going to live in this meaningless field. I just don't know quite yet what by. I know two things. Communism and Christianity don't work. I'm speaking more for the European world. So in this vacuum of meaning, two things are sure. Christianity is dead, and so is communism. So let's see what else we can find. Maybe some good French bread. That's a little bit going on there. It's curious because we're very close to what Anne Rice said, that is just a miserable place of being locked in. It's a meaningless world, and the two hope givers in the 20th century, Christianity and communism, didn't pan out. Christianity already for centuries, communism for the 20th century. Then there's another self-assertion, and that is the appeal of activism. This is nearly a spiritual or a religious right that says, I don't care about theories, I don't care about philosophies, I want action. We sit on our hands, we talk all day long, do something, change the world. Be an activist. So there is still a very strong appeal here that there's something transcendent, not in the old metaphysical way, but in the sense of going beyond yourself to do something. Yes? Well, we'll maybe be able to go there a little bit. Another self-assertion is religious competition. That's been a surprise with the rise of Islam, that in the world, in Europe particularly, a shocking realization that there may be religious competition and that there's actually self-assertion. Now in Europe, the way it plays out is mostly that some Islamic groups are expressing self-assertion, but not in the counterparts in the various churches, so that's a whole subgroup on its own. And then among self-assertions is a claim or a postulate, a demand for spiritual pluralism. I think some of us feel that, some of us a little less. You are okay to say, I am a follower of Christ. Maybe you may be considered a fool. Maybe that's a little bit old-fashioned, but it's okay. But if you say, I am a follower of Christ, who is the way, the truth, and life, to whom Muhammad and Buddha will have to bow, then you're done with. So there is a self-assertion in various cultural strands that say you must clip the wings of any exclusive claim because, as the argument goes, Judaism, Islam, and Christianity all have these same exclusive truth claims. And you're just locked in your own little Christian community and you need to clip that because there's no peace without that. So there's a strong pressure for spiritual pluralism and then spiritual postmodernism. We don't need to go into that too much. Okay, militant theocratic Islam would be another self-assertion. Here are these three piles. And coming back from Germany, I picked up this little magazine. I'll just pass it around. That gives me more. Maybe I'll find another pile, but I'm assuming that it will just enlarge this list. And you know from your own experiences and encounters some other subcategories of these. But what I want to remind us of is that behind these piles are lives and hearts and experiences and thoughts and pains that are complex. There are yearnings, there are honest opennesses, and there are demands. And so what does Jesus now do as he calls into discipleship? So I'm going to try and bridge just briefly. That would take a long time to develop that, but I want to hear from you. I believe that Jesus leads every person that wants to follow him into a crisis, a dual crisis, namely the crisis of self-perception and the crisis of God-perception. Who am I really? And that question Jesus pursues with his disciples, that question Jesus pursues with us, and I can't develop that here, but it is a wonderful thing to behold that Jesus really asks this fundamental question before we get to these three categories. Who am I? And I believe one of the most fundamental self-admissions is I am self-determining. I am self-driven. The scriptures calls it sin. I do my own. I seek my own. And the crisis of God perception is whatever perspective of God the disciples have, Jesus has to modify, particularly in the sense that there is a complex deity as the creator of this universe. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, three persons in perfect unity. And at one point, this unity is separated, and there's the incarnation of the Son that comes after you in order to bring you back into this reconciled relationship with God. So there's something very fundamental going on here in human existence. And so I would argue that the person and the work of Christ is the answer to the double crisis of who am I and who is God. I find that God is a loving, pursuing, self-sacrificing God who goes after you to help you get out of your prison, Monsieur Camus. He loves you enough, he goes after you, because you are locked in an existential prison that he quite understands. Page number 2 then goes into some details that I'm going to skip. So I'm just going to go to 3, and then I'll take some questions. I am trying to connect Jesus' call to follow him with the three areas of spiritual yearnings, self-disclosures, and self-assertions. How does Jesus encounter that? The first one is the spiritual yearning here in the middle of page 3. Jesus invites to follow him and to be with him. If he's just a religious leader, if he's just some master, that's a trip. If indeed he is part of the complex God that we worship, who made this world, then to be invited by him into that fellowship is actually to come back home, in Augustinian terms, to find peace with God. And so here I would say all are invited by that call to discipleship due to a safe authority that Jesus has and a personal relationship that he draws into. There is true hope for peace. There is even room for fruitful tradition and ritual. So it's not this cut everything off because now it is only Jesus, but it is to be brought into the true longings, of which these other ones are shadows, remnants. So there's even room for imagination. Jesus has a wonderful sense of imagination in the parables, the stories, and the questions that he asks. There's room to breathe. Spiritual self-disclosures, the antidote is confession. Repent and lay out your heart. Discipleship enables openness, the safeness of relationship with Jesus, the self-sacrificial love, makes room for confessing wrongdoing. I think as a Christian community, we can confess our wrongdoing because we have been put into a safe place. Now, not indiscriminately to tell everybody about everything, but we have the room to be honest, the place to be honest. We have safe love in Jesus. He heals from hypocrisy and brokenness, and that was a wonderful thing in the testimony last week, how Susanna began to see her own brokenness, her own inconsistency, her own division, internal division, and how she was led out of that brokenness by confession. And then Jesus protects from evil. I think that's a thing that young converts who have dabbled in Spiritism will discover and will find, that we may not be so connected with that God, that Jesus is powerful over evil spirits who indeed do exist. And Jesus then leads to what I would call beneficial suffering, some meaningfulness in suffering, some cleansing in suffering, something quite hard to grasp. It's not masochistic, it's not self-abasing, but there's something wholesome, something cleansing in the path of suffering. Jesus leads out of fate. It's a personal relationship with a personal Lord. And then the third one is interesting again, self-assertions. You know, Jesus is not a marshmallow, come, let's have a good time together and hold hands and sing Kumbaya. But he is one who both calls and echoes the spiritual yearning. He's one who gives room to self-disclose and say, yeah, I was morally completely inconsistent, like Susanna did in such a wonderful way. But he also says, you must repent. There's something in you that is so self-determining, so self-orientated. You begin with yourself and you finish with yourself. You do not begin with the existence of God. So repentance, metanoia, your renewal of your mind and life disposition and worldview has to happen. There's no way around it. We can't just hold hands and sing Kumbaya. You have to go through a radical change of perspective, but that's not the only thing that Jesus does in his call to discipleship, and I find that wonderful. Turn from autonomy, from a self-sufficiency to a God dependency, and to accept a universe in which there are moral absolutes. Susanna was impressed by her then boyfriend, what's his name, Joe, saying, I have commitments. There is right and wrong. There is truth. And he conveyed it not in an abrasive, haughty way, but in a way of him submitting to that world. And that impressed itself on her. So Jesus challenges here. He is the truth. Jesus would be absolutely unhelpful to us if he said, I am one way. I'm a path. He has to be true to himself, like you identify yourself by your own name. So there's a radical change that has to happen, and there's no way around it. And so all three together, then I would say Jesus calls to holistic worship of the true God as the unifying core of authentic existence. Jesus matures his disciples to godliness, responsibility, and action. And here I have one quote from the Old Testament and one from the New, and then I'll take questions, or take your cards, that is. There's the heart cry in Psalm 42:1. As a deer pants for flowing streams, so pants my soul for you, O God. And this is the call of Jesus in Matthew 11. Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I'm gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Okay, what I would like to suggest is if you can just pass the cards out and forward, and then I will just look through them and hopefully take some of your questions still and discuss some of the issues. I think that will be most helpful. So pass them to the sides and forward if you have a question, and then I will try and deal a little bit with those some more detail. Thank you for your patient attention. Thank you.
What I'm going to do, what I'm going to do too is I'm going to hand out, I think there's 30 copies of this. This is from the original Jewish Kabbalah. Okay, anybody who's, take one, there's 30. So if we do one per household, there's probably enough. If you're particularly interested in reading a little bit more, there's 15 copies. This goes into a little bit more detail, so I'll pass these around too, and feel free to take one. If there are not enough of these, and you would like one, I'll give you the website. You can get it off yourself. Okay. Yeah, actually, we discovered that these cards were from my Lutheran church in New Jersey from the 1950s.
I knew
think
they
that's
were Lutheran.
Why they're. That's why they're yellow.
I knew they were Lutheran cards.
Okay. Questions? Anybody?
Okay. There is a wonderful list of questions already. Thank you. Oh, man. Okay. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to start with one. Regarding spiritual yearnings, which is the first pile that I have kind of identified, even as a Christian, I feel some of the yearnings listed. Community, connection to nature, is there something we as Christians can learn or glean from seekers around us? And the simple answer is absolutely yes. That's the first thing. And the other aspect is that what we find in some of these spiritual yearnings as a shadow, as an echo, are to be realized around the truth of the existence of God and his effect, his transforming effect on our lives. And one thing that I've been so impressed by in the book of Acts is that where God's mission happens, God's transforming mission happens, there's always community. So, in fact, here, this yearning for community and then also connection to nature, but yearning for community, it's a very natural thing that a godly community is formed. So if you read Dietrich Bonhoeffer's book on life together in the whole process of discipleship, it's a wonderful reflection of how God then draws us into it. What we have to be careful about as followers of Christ is to idealize community, because we're still fallible, we still hurt, we still live selfishly, and so there's all kinds of pain and difficulty and pain involved in community living. But I would certainly say these yearnings are not automatically satisfied when we begin to follow Christ. That's a false kind of preaching of the gospel, I would say. But they are addressed. And as we learn to surrender to God's ways and to each other, we will grow in community. And the connection to nature is just so natural because, in some ways, Scripture is the special revelation of God, but His handiwork out there is reflecting His glory. And now, as followers of Christ, we can praise Him for both. So I would say very much so and very well put. Another possible spiritual yearning. So this is a further suggestion here. For a leader who inspires hope, radical change, transcendence, actions. Mussolini, Hitler, FDR, Kennedy, etc., etc. Now, that is certainly possible that there are some transcendent elements connected with that. I have studied to some degree Hitler's appeal in the German society that was very depressed and hopeless around 1933 in the wake of First World War, an enormous amount of unemployment, etc. And with Hitler, I do find a combination of a hope giver, something beyond the individual, and then there are spiritual elements to his person that I would identify as demonic. So yes, very much a part of this. Do you think the trends of self-disclosure include the current popularity of confessional websites? I didn't even know that confessional websites were around, so I'm learning here. Or post-secret postcards where you confess sins, secrets sent anonymously. I think so, and that's a strange phenomenon that I think there's this strange desire to have everything public, whole life. I mean, recently Covenant Seminary posted some things about us more on the web, and I felt like somebody was taking my jacket off. You know, I just don't like that. I'm a more private person. So whoever wrote this note here, self-disclosure, current popularity of confessional websites. I don't know if anybody has a little bit of a further contribution to that, younger people especially. I'm fascinated by it, but yeah. Is it perhaps an outcry of loneliness that you disclose yourself so much? That's wonderful. So maybe that should be added to the spiritual. Yes, Jane mentioned that the whole longing to be known is such an important aspect of our human existence, and that would be part of it. Could it also be that this way of confessional websites doesn't have shame or personal responsibility connected with that? So you can be known, but it's, no, don't get close to me. A little bit of what you said, you know. Mm. Yeah, I think I need to add that here, the longing to be known, yes. Yes. To put a confession out on the website and find other people who echo that. In some ways, outside of the website, it is the strength, for instance, of Alcoholics Anonymous that you see somebody struggle with the same thing. It's greatly encouraging. So there's a positive aspect, obviously, in this confession, but the web does have a dimension to it that is very difficult for me to accept. Whereas if you speak with somebody and that other person says, you know, I have gone through the same thing, that is deeply encouraging. There's that encouragement aspect to it. I think you wanted to... So it's the only way to get it out there, you're saying.
Or if people do it because they long for it, like, let's say, Michael, you are speaking to that. I am.
It's not on.
People long for, sorry. they long for intimacy, so maybe they're sexually promiscuous, right? So they long to be known. Well, in sexual promiscuous relationships, it's not the right context for that level of intimacy, so there's a great deal of shame associated with it. And on the internet, these blogs, people put their heart and soul out there, but there's not that level of trust. It's not the right context for that depth of sharing. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if really there is a lot of shame connected to it. I don't know.
Yes, please.
It was my question, but I would agree with Michael, just because as I've read, I'm fascinated by the whole post-secret movement, and if you haven't heard about it, there's this guy who has agreed to receive anonymous postcards from people who just want to tell a secret, something that they're carrying with them, and you know, in the introduction of his book, he talks about how people are so relieved to have somewhere to send this. Because I think they do have God's law written on their heart, even if they don't profess faith. And I think that they do carry shame and guilt and just want to be relieved of it, even though this isn't the right way. I think they have a longing for it.
So there would be an appropriate human relationship pendant to that, that we create safe places where a person can actually open up and share. Which, you know, I mean, I come from Germany, which is a very private society. In my perception, Americans are extremely open. But even here, we could say, compared to that need to be known and to be able to share, where do we need to grow to provide that kind of safety? And one thing that I would think is confidentiality. I think that the grapevine of sharing prayer concerns is very destructive. So we need to prove ourselves to be trustworthy recipients of that kind of sharing so that a person would actually find that in a human being rather than post-secret way. Okay, let me see. There's a wonderful question, but I can't address it. It's, could you please explain how Mark 8 addresses the crisis of self-perception and the question, who do you think you are? That would take us into a 3-hour escapade. So I'm not going to do that, but it's fascinating to me that Jesus does not say, do these 10 things and you'll be my follower, but rather he does go to that fundamental drive, that fundamental question. So,
Hans, can you at least tell us what's in that text for those of us who don't know?
It's basically where Jesus says, be aware and be warned of the yeast of the Pharisees. Do you see and have not eyes to see? Do you ears and do not have ears to hear? So he warns the disciples about things that he sees around them. And if you study, for instance, the yeast of the Pharisees, you understand that it's a self-reliance, self-dependency. So in some ways, Jesus begins to mirror to the disciples what they don't see in a very fundamental way, long before he would say, if you want to be my follower, you need to do this, or you need to approach things in that way. So there's some kind of a foundational work, and the same thing regarding his own person, that the disciples have to see, what kind of God are we really worshiping? Who is he really as a loving, pursuing God? Okay, let me do one more. It's hard to choose. Does self-disclosures and admission language indicate that there is a sense that there should be shame and guilt over these things? What differentiates attraction in the category from yearning? Let's see. The first one, this should be shame and guilt over these things. Yes, there is a sense of guilt associated with that. When I tried to analyze self-disclosures, I did not approach it from a moral perspective. I simply wanted to say, what do people say about themselves? And it is interesting that we are in a stronger amoral world and context. There are no rights and wrongs and goods and evils. So I simply connect with the spirit world. There are some beings out there, and I just have a great sense of transcendence to engage those. And it's nothing new, you know. Paul speaks about engaging with angels in Colossians. There was an angel mysticism in Asia Minor. So I think this guilt and shame comes when you are drawn by the call of Christ. And that was beautiful when we saw Susanna describe her movement from an amoral, neutral kind of a world to a world where there is actually self-admission to wrong. It was amazing how she traced that. So I would say, as we analyze and look out, we will find a broad spectrum that is amoral. Not immoral, but moral categories just don't figure. They don't matter. So whatever is being done is just experience. You know, I experience certain things. Once you move into the call of Christ, then there is the question of good and evil, truth and falsehood, and confession. Yeah.
What
differentiates a self-disclosure and a self-assertion? I would say a self-disclosure is simply admitting something, whereas a self-assertion is postulating, demanding something. I am not going to let go of this. So a self-disclosure is, you know, you could link it. They're not absolutely separate, but a self-disclosure is just that's how I'm wired. That's what I do. But you could argue that some of the self-disclosures are actually self-determinations. Okay, I think we need to close here. I really appreciate you just reflecting on that. And let me just encourage you as we move on in serving Christ, that what is going on around us is tragic life, is pained life, is real life. And what we get to learn as followers of Christ is to understand, sympathize, learn, and study, and then also to communicate, and some of you are very good communicators, how the call of Christ relates to those worlds in which our friends and neighbors and relatives are living in right now. And I think then we are being more lights and salt where God has placed us. So thank you very much, and blessings to you.